And in Vietnam, half a century later, where almost all the capital was French, some British. But they went in to stop a competing system that would use the land, the labor, the resources, and the markets in a different way, not for the enrichment of the few, but for the needs of the many. They went in there to defend their class interests, their class power interests. And that's what it's about. And now today you've got the U.S. saying not only that we want to preserve a global free market paradise, but it's got to be a U.S. global paradise. The U.S. has got to be the only superpower, and we will not tolerate the emergence of another superpower, even a capitalist one. And we will not tolerate the emergence of regional powers. Regional powers can cause problems too. We want you shattered, we want you broken, we want you weak, and we want you hungry, and we want you desperate, because the hungrier and the weaker you are, the harder you will work for less and less, and the more I get for me. That's the name of the game, the expropriation of surplus value, the expropriation of a whole social order. Capitalism is more than just an economic system, it's a social and cultural and ideological order, and we have got to fight it and defend ourselves from it. Now, U.S. support of police state terrorism and torture, I want to return to my opening point, isn't an irrational policy. It may foster, it may feed off irrational fears, it may feed off irrational impulses, it may recruit irrational impulses. It may recruit distorted personalities who get off being torturers or bombing villages from a jet, you know, and watching them burn and all that sort of thing. It may do that, but its goals, what it is directed at, is rooted in some very rational interests. In every country where the U.S. has gone in and done these things, where human rights, where economic rights, where political rights, social rights have been destroyed by U.S.-sponsored state terrorism, in every one of these countries, labor organizations have been destroyed or seriously mangled, wages have declined, profits have increased, tax laws have been made more favorable to transnational corporations, and the investment climate improves. Iraq is now another case. The Iraqi Revolution of 1958 was only partially overthrown by a CIA coup in 1968. By 1970, the agency of that CIA coup was a group known as the Ba'athist Party. The leader who emerged was one man named Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein then proceeded to murder, torture, brutalize every Democrat, every progressive, every communist, every labor leader, every peasant leader, murdered them and destroyed the progressive forces of that Iraqi revolution, or drove them underground or into exile. Saddam Hussein was Washington's poster boy. He couldn't do any wrong. In fact, he was then sigged on to Iran to go do some dirty work there and try to overthrow this anti-American revolution in Iran. But he also did some other funny things. In 1972, he took an oil industry, which had belonged, back in 1958, had belonged to British and U.S. oil companies. He took this oil industry and he nationalized it. And you know how this infuriates people in the West? You know how this infuriates oil investors? When these people in these countries take our oil, which happens to be in their soil, take it from us, steal our oil from us, that's oil which belongs to us. Well, it infuriated people, and they, there was the Cold War was on, and he was doing other things, so they left him alone for a while. Comes the overthrow of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, scores are going to be settled. It's like Yugoslavia, too. We don't have to tolerate this guy anymore, they say in the White House. Saddam Hussein, I should add, was doing some other things, too. He started copying the left agenda to a limited degree, not with the same egalitarianism. But he set up education programs. He trained cadres of engineers. He put in public health programs. He did a number of things like this. there are many countries in the Middle East that have oil but no water. There are others that have water and no oil. Iraq was the only one that had both. It had a good ecological base. Yugoslavia did too. It was destroyed by depleted uranium from the bombings, which many of our progressives and liberals supported, those bombings against Yugoslavia. In Iraq too, the same thing has happened. A very good agricultural base which has been destroyed by depleted uranium for infinite generations. I mean, what evil is this? How broadly can you define your own interests, and how narrowly do you find other people's interests so that you can just poison them and destroy them and all that to gain some advantage for yourself, real or imagined? So Iraq had the highest standard of living in the Middle East, which isn't saying too much, but it wasn't that bad. War does some other things too. War also has domestic political advantages. War makes your leader a great hero. You know, we know some of our compatriots, don't we? We know some of our fellow Americans who never stop saying, who are quite capable of saying cynical things. Politicians, they say one thing to you to get elected, then they do something else when they're in office. They talk for the little guy, but they end up helping the fat cats. I mean, you hear people say that. But when those same politicians wrap themselves around in the flag, and when they point to some evil out there, some threat that's going to come get you, why then our same compatriots suddenly discard their cynicism, discard their skepticism, and with childlike trust, they say, we've got to support the president. We've got to support the president. You know, I heard a student once say to me, he said, that's the difference between you and me. He said, I have faith in President Bush. He was talking about George I. He says, I have faith. I said, excuse me? You have faith in the president? What are we doing here, religion or politics? You have faith in Georgie Bush? Like my Italian grandma had faith in St. Anthony. You have a picture of Bush on your bureau with a little candle. You light it, you go, oh, Madonna, Georgie Bush. He said, well, I trust the president. I said, there too, you trust the president? Trust, is that what we're dealing with here? Trust, which is something that you should reserve only for your friends and close companions or close family members. And even them, check them all out once in a while, right? You're all laughing, you know, right? No, democracy is not about trust. Democracy is about distrust. It's about accountability. It's about exposure. It's about debate. It's about getting the things out on the table. It's about challenging them. That's what it's about. So perpetual war is very useful to these people. To this slime bag who's president now, Georgie Bush, he wants war all the time. Except this last one isn't going that well, so he's cooled back a little. But war suspends the critical judgment of people. They all rally around the leader. You know, the Germans were doing that, or some segment of Germany was pushing that line. It was called Führerprinzip. Right? The leadership principle, that in the Führer, in the leader of the state, there's the embodiment of the state. And what he says is it. That's the expression of our very souls. As Rudolf Hess said about Adolf Hitler at the big Nuremberg rally, he says, do not search for Adolf Hitler with your brains. You will find him with your hearts. Adolf Hitler is Germany, and Germany is Adolf Hitler. And in an American idiom, that's sort of what we're getting here. No, I mean, it's that Americans wouldn't go quite for a line like that. But it's say, trust our leader. We have to do this. We're facing these dangers, and we all have to rally, support our troops, blah, 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 and check your brains at the door. Check your critical facilities, and any expression of critical intelligence will be treated as a manifestation of lack of patriotism and treason and cavorting with the terrorists. That's the kind of line that they're trying to feed us. Well, perpetual war, perpetual crisis does that. It's also a way of covering domestic sins, you know. Federalist Paper number 6, Alexander Hamilton, 1787, he said, 1787, He said, many a leader pursues overseas adventures so to distract the people from their domestic grievances. Does that sound familiar at all? And in July of last year, not this July, the July before this one, the Republican Party was reeling from those scandals, Enron, Halliburton, Harkin, all of these things. The Republican Party was seen as the party of corporate scandal. And two of their top leaders, the president and vice president, both implicated in insider trading, so obviously refusing to cooperate, refusing to hand over documents. In July of 2002, by November, the airwaves, by October rather, the airwaves were filled with war talk. Iraq, Iraq, war talk, war talk. The Republican Party now reemerged as the party of defense, patriotism, a strong America protecting us from this mortal threat, this imminent danger, Saddam Hussein, who is going to attack us any day with weapons of mass delusion. And they won a midterm election that they should have never won. Along with maintaining superpower status and along with these domestic advantages, another domestic advantage, let me mention, as you know, is making the war against democracy, because democracy is a real challenge to capitalism. Democracy was a wonderful invention by the people of history. That's what it was under Cleisthenes in ancient Greece in the 5th century, 4th century. That's what it was in Rome in the late 6th century BC and for 500 years. Democracy was an invention by the people of history, the ordinary working people of history. I wrote a book about it. It's right there called The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. It was an invention by the people to protect themselves against the abuses of wealth. That's what democracy was. It was born in class struggle, and that's what it still is today, and that's why it's very annoying and very bothersome to the powers that be. And a way to get around it is to circumscribe it, to limit it, to intimidate people, to pass repressive laws, all again under the guise of protecting you and saving you from some terror. And we hear that the terrorists are after us because we're rich, we're prosperous, and we're free. And they hate this about us. But you know what? I've been doing some reading. I read an interview of Osama bin Laden by Robert Fisk in an old issue of The Nation, 1998. I just happened to find it in a pile of materials. And he says, America is the demon and is our enemy because they have betrayed us, they've come here, they've destroyed our way, they've undermined us. The guys who tried to blow up the World Trade Center and killed, how many, 200 people the first time, remember in 1993 when they went on trial? They said, we attacked you because you won't leave us alone, because you've come to our countries, you've taken our wealth, you take our land. That's what they say. They don't say it's because, oh, we're just so jealous of you, you got everything, and we got nothing. They say, we just want you to leave us alone. We want you to get your boot off the back of our neck. That's why they do this. So I know a way, the best way we could fight terrorism is by undermining and getting rid of the causes of terrorism, by leaving those people alone and helping them in their popular movements and in their attempts to build a better life instead of supporting their oppressors and becoming their oppressors. Don't take my word for it. Everything I've been saying here, don't take my word for it. We always say that actions speak louder than words. There are times when words speak louder than actions. When you're trying to decide what is the intent of an action, where the person can't deny the action, but they deny the intent and they give you another thing. The problem with trying to establish the intent is that nobody's ever seen an intent or a motive. It's not empirical. It's not an empirical thing. Intent is something that is only ascribed or imputed or, deducted. You say, well, he did that because of this, I think, and you look at it that way. Now, what's very interesting is when some people, like rulers, come out and actually give the real intent. They don't talk about democracy and this and that. They tell you what their real interests are. Let me read you one of a member of the ruling class. He was a partner, senior partner, in one of the richest corporate lawyer firms in America, in New York. It was called the Dulles Brothers. His brother, Alan Dulles, served for a stretch as director of the CIA. He himself, John Foster Dulles, was Secretary of State under Dwight Eisenhower. And this is what he says. He actually comes out and he says it. He says, in order to bring a nation to support the burden of maintaining great military establishments all over the world and at home, it is necessary to create an emotional state akin to war psychology. There must be the portrayal of external menace. This involves the development to a high degree of the hero nation versus the villain nation ideology, and the arousing of the population to a sense of sacrifice. Once these exist, we have gone a long way on the path to war. And he's being very positive about this. He's saying this is a good thing, clever thing. That's John Foster Dulles. So they come out and they say it. I want to read to you one other thing. This was written by a man named Tom Watson. He was a U.S. senator in 1898. He wasn't a Democrat and he wasn't a Republican. He was a populist. And the populists were People's Party, especially strong in the South and the West, with a lot of working class support and a lot of poor farmer support. And they had actually elected a few senators, and they also elected a few governors and some members of the House of Representatives. Watson was a senator at this time. In 1898, that's when the U.S. went into this war against Spain to grab Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines and become an empire. But that isn't the story they fed to the people. They said, we got to go in just to help the poor Cubans who are being mercilessly treated by the Spaniards. So that's why we're doing this, just because we're so upset about the Cubans and their cotton and their tobacco and their sugar and the Philippines, which they never mentioned at all. They just went and sent an army and a fleet to the Philippines. Well, the war hype got stirred up, and this is what Watson observed, and this is what he wrote. The Spanish war has finished us reformers. The blare of the bugle drowns the voice of the reformer. Who gets the benefit of the war? This is Watson. The bond seekers, the capitalists, the railroads. National bankers will profit by this war. The new bonds give them the basis for new banks, and their power is prolonged. The privileged classes all profit by this war. It takes the attention of the people off economic issues and perpetuates the unjust economic system they have put upon us. Politicians profit by the war. It buries issues they dare not meet. What do the people get out of this war? The fighting and the taxes. What is the United States doing in this war with Spain in the first place? True, Spain is oppressing Cuba, but so is England oppressing Ireland, Egypt, and India. This is 1898 now. France is oppressing Siam and Madagascar. Turkey is oppressing Armenia. Should we then take up arms against the oppressors of the world? We would more likely end up by becoming oppressors ourselves. The Spaniards and Cubans were bushwhacking one another and killing from 3 to 5 men at a battle. We have gone down there and killed more people in 3 months than they would have killed in 13 years. If they were starving before, who feeds them now? What are we going to get out of this war as a nation? Endless trouble, complications, expense. Republics can't go into the conquering business and remain republics. Militarism leads to military domination, military despotism. Imperialism smooths the way for the emperor. And as you know, in every president, there's an emperor that's trying to get out, you know. Now, these guys don't quite have it just the way they want it, having said all this. They got really surprised and very seriously shaken up last January, February, December, January, February, March. You see, George Bush got a free ride into Afghanistan because of 7-11, 9-11. A salute. There were some of us who did demonstrate against that war, but he really pretty much got what he wanted. He was fighting terrorism. He was supposed to have gotten the Taliban. He said the most single important thing is to get this Osama bin Laden, you know, the demonized individual we get. When he couldn't find him, he said, it's not important at all. It doesn't matter. Now, they expected the very same thing the next year, and that didn't happen. Rather extraordinary things began to happen, and there are people in this room who played a good role in making that happen. But hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions of people began to voice their objection and demonstrating all over the United States. Not just about the ones we heard about in San Francisco and Washington, D.C., but in L.A., in Seattle, in places all around the country. All over the world, people were demonstrating. In London, 2 million people, the largest demonstration in English history. In Spain, 81% of the people against the war. In Madrid, in every city, in every town, every night. You know, in Spain, nothing starts till about 10 at night. There are civilized people. Out there every night demonstrating against this war for weeks on end. In Italy, 78% of the people against the war. In Greece, 90-something percent of the people against the war. Demonstrations in every one of these countries. In Germany, the Germans against the war, even the Germans. Finland, in Lithuania, in Indonesia, in Argentina, in Nigeria, in Mexico. Vicente Fox, just aching to be another lapdog for the American president, couldn't do it, right? Because all of Mexico is against that war. And in Japan, big demonstrations in Osaka, Kyoto, Tokyo, against the war, Indonesia. You could go on and on. All over the world, coordinated actions like this. This shook the hell out of the White House. These guys were really, they dropped that stuff about shock and awe. We'll go in, we're going to blow, hit everything, and just the ones we don't kill will be left vegetables and we'll just stroll in. Then they dropped that and they said, this is all for democracy. This is all for liberation, you see. And they've had to hold to that line. And today now they're caught in a people's resistance. They're subjected to something like anywhere from 10 to 20 attacks a day. They're losing, according to the U.S. commander, 3 to 6 men with 40 seriously wounded every week. They're in a war, a people's war now. And they could do real counterinsurgency, and they're doing some of it. They're killing a lot of Iraqis. They're rounding people up and they're shooting them. But they also can't quite do that. They have to keep this pretense that we're here as liberators, not occupiers. We're here to help these poor little backwood people. 5,000-year civilization, we're helping these poor little backwood people. Teach them how to rule themselves. We're doing all this stuff, you see. And so he's got the power. He's got the firepower. He's got the death delivery. He can go and destroy everything that's standing in Iraq, but he doesn't have the political power. He's faced with a political situation that we've created, and we've got him boxed in. And that's an important thing to remember. And when people say, oh, we demonstrated, and he had the war anyway, I said, I never doubted that this war would happen. These demonstrations weren't to stop the war. It was to contain it. It was to box them in. It was to hold them in and show them that the people are still there. And the people are very, very much in motion. Now, these were countries, what countries I'm talking about? Mexico, Japan. They have no historical or cultural link to Iraq or religious or ethnic link. They were supporting this war for two reasons. One, out of regard for the Iraqi people, and two, out of regard for themselves, too, because they were opposing the idea of this planetary monarch arising and saying, I shall decide who lives and who dies. We, the United States, now will honor no international treaties. They said that. These treaties are not to be honored. We will attack any country we want whenever we say, and when we deem that that country might be a menace or meets our disapproval. And we will reserve the right to be first to use nuclear power. And now look what he's doing. With overweening, utter arrogance, he turns to the UN, the same UN he was spitting at just last year, spitting at them and saying, you got to decide whether you're the United Nations or the League of Nations. We'll go in with or without you. We don't need you. And all the yahoos were saying, yeah, yeah, USA, whoa, whoa, as if they were watching a goddamn basketball game or something. But now he turns around and goes to the UN and asks them to help pick up the blood tab. Pick up some of the blood on this. And pick up some of the financial costs. And the UN is saying, that's very interesting. Oh, very interesting. You know he's lost political control when Kofi Annan, who jumps to anything the U.S. wants, who spends his whole life, U.S. When Kofi Annan turns around and says, hey, this is the United Nations, we're not going to get into this kind of stuff. Go in, come in with us, but at an advisory role, and the U.S. calls all the shots. So how can you refuse an offer like that? And he says, we refuse. Kofi Annan said, we refuse. Because the people of the world have refused, and the people of the world are making themselves heard. And that's the important thing. That the people of the world make themselves heard, that we fight, that we struggle, that we go at this thing, that we don't compromise, we don't give up, we don't get discouraged, we just keep going. Well, some people say to me, oh, you got a conspiracy theory, huh? I always run into that. Do you get that? I mean, you think these people intend to do this deliberately? I said, no, they're just sleepwalkers and they just happen. They throw a dart at the map and say, well, let's attack Iraq. Yeah, that's a... Or let's attack this country there. Of course they plan. Of course they plan these things. I said, you really think there's a group of men sitting around in a room? Somehow that image really throws them out. Sitting around in a room and planning this? I said, oh, no, they're not sitting around in a room. They're meeting on carousels, you know, and they're talking like that. And they're skydiving and they're holding hands saying, yeah, we got to do this, get a new Uruguay round and... increase the military budget and increase our profits and all that. Yeah, of course they sit around in rooms. Where the hell else you think they're going to sit around? They got plenty of rooms in the White House. They got plenty of rooms at the Council for Foreign Relations. They got plenty of rooms at the Bilderberg Conference. They got plenty of rooms at the Knickerbocker Club in New York, at the Bohemian Grove, and the Bohemian Club in San Francisco. You know, back in 1991, I looked at the... Bilderberg Conference attendees, they meet every, 2-3 years, named after Bilderberg, the hotel where they first met. These are the ruling elites, the leaders, political, economic, corporate leaders with a few top media people and a few straight professors to write their position papers for them, a few little lackey-hired prostitutes. Apology to the prostitutes who are working girls who don't have a choice in this thing. And I'm looking at this 1990, and so, you know, this big stack. And so I immediately, of course, I turned to the United States. I want to see who from the United States went to the Bilderberg Conference. The first name is no surprise. David Rockefeller of Rockefeller Brothers Association. Aren't you glad you got representation here in these world conferences? They're protecting our interests here, Ron. The second name really puzzled me and surprised me. I had heard of him. And I know he sent his National Guard down to Guatemala and seemed like one of those governors who was cozy with the CIA or something, but I knew nothing about him. It said, the Honorable Bill Clinton, Governor of Arkansas. I said, what the hell's the Governor of Arkansas doing rubbing shoulders and holding hands with David Rockefeller? And then six months later, I found out. He was suddenly in the media as the front runner Democratic candidate for president of the United States. He was the guy who was able to get WTO past a Democratic Congress. So of course they plan. Of course they are always planning. And we too have to organize and we have to plan. So remember that the empire achieves its goals by consuming the resources of the republic. the empire achieves its power by devouring the liberties of the republic. So the fight we face now, the struggle against U.S. globalism, is a struggle for the heart and soul of democracy itself. Thank you for your kind attention.
That was Dr. Michael Parenti speaking last October in Los Angeles. Thanks to the LA Sound Posse for this recording. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This week, I'm going to read from Chapter 7 of Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000, which I've been reading installments from over the past 6 weeks or so. If you're just joining the program, Jeff Schmidt's central thesis in the book is that the role of the professional in society is essentially ideological. And whereas professional training purports to be about learning specialized skills that most people think of when they think of professional work, that one of the key components of what actually constitutes the professional's work is to be willing to be ideologically subservient to someone else's agenda. In other words, to put one's creativity in the service of whoever is paying the bill, and not to let one's own feelings, thoughts, and principles interfere with doing one's job. As a result, many who went into professional work hoping to make an important contribution to society feel continually frustrated. Their careers do not live up to their expectations. The net result creates a negative effect on society, as society's most creative positions are often filled by people who do not think independently and will not challenge the status quo. If you've missed previous installments of this reading and you'd like to catch up, you can download old shows on our website, unwelcomeguests.org, in the show archive. The Disciplined Mind readings begin with show number 175. Okay, so this is Chapter 7, titled Opportunity. Non-professionals often seem to resent their place in the social order. Even when they take home more money than their professional co-workers, as when a newspaper editor's secretary, for example, is paid more than entry-level reporters, non-professionals remain much less excited about the status quo. And if non-professionals find society less than inspiring, society is hardly agog about non-professionals. The research assistant on Wall Street, the junior copywriter on Madison Avenue, the international licensing assistant on Fashion Avenue, any of these $25,000 a year professional track beginners have more social status than does the $30,000 secretary or even the $40,000 administrative assistant. If pay rates don't account for the non-professional's greater dissatisfaction and lower social status, then what does? The culprit becomes clear when non-professionals reveal their inner thoughts. It's the nature of non-professional work itself. The typical non-professional today is a white-collar worker, not a blue-collar worker. But while the non-professional workforce may have adopted more fashionable dress, discomfort with the hierarchy remains widespread. Here is Christopher Winks, an insightful office worker, with thoughts stimulated by his first day on a new assignment. He makes clear his dissatisfaction with the very nature of the work, and by doing so hints at the appeal of professional work. Quote, "The office in which I was to be working for the next few weeks was a franchising operation that contracted out secretarial service to clients, among other things. But I only found that out a few hours after I had begun work, immediately after I walked in, introduced myself to the supervisor, and found an empty desk. I was put to work transcribing a tedious legal document, dictated by a disembodied individual who sounded as if he made it a habit to speak with pebbles in his mouth. What struck me about this was that my supervisor had tacitly assumed that what counted in this job, as no doubt with hers, was the what and not the why. You had a job to do, and you did it. And since that unwritten rule obtained in every other corporation, regardless of whether the firms did management consultant, real estate speculation, or constructing nuclear power plants, what difference did it make if the purpose of it all was known? It came down to the same thing, no matter where you worked. The attitude of passive cynicism has always seemed to me to be the most pervasive feeling in offices. The uniformity of the work process has another consequence that hit home as I struggled to keep up with the unending flow of legal babble. No matter what job you do, you can learn everything there is to know about it in a matter of minutes. After that, there are only details, sometimes perverse, sometimes complicated, but always insignificant in comparison to the basic structure of the tasks performed. About an hour after I'd walked in, I felt I'd been working there for months, and I still didn't know what the company did in the first place. The office consisted of a series of cubicles with tall dividers. To speak to anyone, I had to stand up and peer over the partition. Each cubicle was unbelievably cramped. There were no windows, the ceilings were claustrophobically low, and fans spread the stale air around equitably and democratically. After a few minutes of dictaphone transcription, I gazed at the crabbed, stilted words that seemed to be flowing from my fingers, even though they had nothing to do with me, and was uncertain whether I felt contempt, amusement, or utter amazement at what I saw. As the day wore on, I felt recurrent pain in my lower back. The typed material in front of me would become blurred from time to time, as my eyes had to strain more and more under the harsh glare of the fluorescent lights. My head pounded. I craved a stiff drink, or perhaps two or three. I thought I would weep for the sheer frustration and rage of having to sit down in a tiny cubbyhole and transcribe bull beep beep beep, useless, pointless bull beep beep beep, the spirit between mind and body that even easy work demands, and which I was diligently reinforcing despite my better instincts, which in any case were all locked in a little compartment of my brain lest they interfere with the pace, was breaking down. The inhumanity of wage labor can only really be experienced when its effects permeate your entire being. Close quote. When you ask non-professionals why they go to work, most don't talk about building a career, being creative, or making a meaningful contribution to society. They talk about making money. Yet people whose jobs represent little more than an exchange of time for money are only momentarily satisfied when they get their paychecks. As the preceding testimony makes clear, the problem is not the amount of compensation for the work, but lack of satisfaction from the work itself. Even at twice the salary, office worker Christopher Winks would still find it hard to keep his mind from questioning his body as his fingers type out, useless, pointless, bull, beep, beep, beep. An unsatisfying work life is much more than a 40-hour-a-week problem because of its profound effect on your morale when you're off the job. You may be pained to think of it as such, but your job is probably the biggest project of your life. It is probably the only activity in which you will ever devote the most alert of your waking hours with such disciplined regularity, day after day after day. During no other period of comparable length in your life will you make an effort of this magnitude on any project of your own. Then, for all practical purposes, your life's work is at stake, and it is understandable that your most serious struggles are to control it, not sell it at a higher price. A work life controlled by others has severe and inevitable consequences and accounts for much of the stress that individuals suffer. Powerlessness at work can mean many things, all of which are stressful. Difficulty getting assigned to work that is interesting and creative, lack of control over or even sight of the end result of your work, lack of control over how to do your work and when to do it, close supervision, lack of control over the work environment, lack of privacy, vulnerability to sexual harassment, lack of respect, and job insecurity. This unattractive package comes with a worry, although you may try not to think about it, that your blood, sweat, and tears are going into work of questionable societal value, work whose bottom line is enriching some corporation, serving the military, or bolstering some elite. People stuck with such unfulfilling work often find themselves engaging compulsively in any variety of escapes. The escapes themselves are a reliable sign of someone who lacks intrinsically satisfying work. Anxiety eating, alcohol and drug use, compulsive buying, vegetating in front of the TV, total scheduling and extreme busyness, anything to avoid the pain of reflecting on your situation. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt. Continuing on with the next section of Chapter 7, which is titled Dreams of Escape. Non-professionals want some creative control over whatever they are helping to produce, and they want to feel the interaction between that product and society. That is, they want to experience both the technical totality and the social totality of their work. They want a sense of accomplishment from their life work, not merely survival. And of course, they want jobs where they don't have to jump when the boss speaks, where they can control their schedule, and where they are not driven by boring work to live for the next weekend or vacation. Professional jobs are seen as offering such work. Professionals influence what is done and the way it is done, and they get more than money for their efforts. They get recognition as a matter of course, even for the work of their assistants. Professionals are not ignored when decisions are made at work. Their opinions are routinely solicited. And professionals are not bossed like non-professionals. They are allowed some control over how they go about doing their work. One conspicuous manifestation of workers' desire for such dignity is the fact that many white-collar and even some blue-collar non-professionals consider themselves to be professionals, even though their employers, who have the ultimate say, do not. Employment agencies understand and cynically exploit the desire of workers to get more out of their work than a paycheck. Every Sunday, through thousands of misleading or even contrived help-wanted advertisements in newspapers across the country, these job agencies compete to lure white-collar non-professional workers to register with their offices. The advertisements offer not jobs, but careers, and they hold out the false promise of the kind of work and the status that is usually reserved for professionals. The agencies know that ads emphasizing career have greater appeal than those emphasizing money. For workers eager to have some creative control over their work, The prospect of a job that gives even a degradingly small taste of professional activity is a powerful lure. The actual jobs behind these advertisements usually turn out to involve little more than tedious SH-beep-beep work such as typing. Various career training institutes and academies also take advantage of the dissatisfactions of non-professionals. Although these businesses don't train people for real professional jobs any more than the job agencies place people in such jobs, their advertisements on daytime TV, buses, and matchbook covers also make heavy use of the word career as a code for professional work. These rip-off schools often aim their advertisements explicitly at those stuck in dead-end jobs, knowing that this will not significantly limit their audience. Becoming a professional has not always figured so prominently as an answer to the frustration of the worker. More typical has been the strategy touted by 19th century writer Horatio Alger, whose rags-to-riches stories hyped the notion of the self-made man. Seeking to realize the dreams made more feasible by such tales, countless workers have saved their hard-earned wages toward the day when they would start their own businesses, become their own bosses, and make their escape from working-class life. Even today, many base their hope on this classic version of the American dream. While the dream does come true for a very few, most who try to make it lose their life savings in the attempt. Nevertheless, as in a lottery, the mere existence of success stories, few as they may be, is enough to attract keen interest in playing the generally tragic game. The odds don't matter much when it is your only perceived chance of escape. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Okay, I'm going to the next section of Chapter 7. And this subsection is titled Opportunity to Escape. However, as the large corporations and conglomerates have grown and extended their tentacles into virtually every neighborhood, all but the very least profitable areas of economic life have been removed from the game, and ever fewer workers see real opportunity in their freedom to enter the competition and become their own bosses. This diminished sense of opportunity is an important side effect of corporate expansion. If not offset by new sources of perceived opportunity, it would soon lead to serious trouble for the corporations themselves, because the perception of opportunity is key in selling the undemocratic workplace to those at the bottom, the workers, whose cooperation the corporations need. Opportunity is held up as something that makes up for the hierarchical nature of the system of production. People would resent more strongly and oppose with greater unity a setup that they felt not only deprived them of dignity, but also denied them any opportunity to achieve it. Widespread belief in individual opportunity protects the system from potentially devastating attack. It protects a backward setup in which a minute number of people exercise control over the nation's huge amount of capital in industry, agriculture, and transportation, while vast numbers of people work that capital and get nothing more than monetary compensation for their time. Individual opportunity is a powerful component of American ideology, powerful enough to elicit support for the system from all quarters, even from many exploited and unorganized workers who are at their boss's mercy. If workers destined to be used up and discarded by employers cling nevertheless to the American way, it is not because they are ignorant of their destiny, but because they sense it. They feel that their only ray of hope for a satisfying life emanates from the opportunity the American system offers. Ironically, the more agonizing the position of such individuals in the hierarchy, and the more desperately they're craving for a way out, the more emotional may be their defense of the system. Thus, through the ideology of individual opportunity, the system can keep the majority of workers in stressful and alienating jobs, and even get some enthusiastic support just by maintaining the opportunity for a few workers to escape their survival-oriented work lives. How do the corporations keep the crucial ideology of opportunity alive now that they no longer pretend that you have any real chance of entering into competition with them? Through a simple shift in the mechanism. Now your vehicle for escape is propelled not by your opportunity to compete with the corporations, but by your opportunity to compete within them. The classic strategy, of course, is to start at the bottom and work your way up on the job. However, work is increasingly organized in ways that obstruct or completely block this pathway. With the ever finer divisions of job tasks, for example, employees learn fewer skills doing their jobs, so that their work does not naturally broaden their knowledge and prepare them for advancement. Their narrow assignments typecast them and keep them playing the same specialized job roles even when they change employers. Workers who manage to overcome this problem face increasingly strict barriers that prevent them from advancing beyond non-professional jobs unless they have the right paper credentials, which they cannot get at work. Hence, today's model strategy for positioning yourself within the employing institutions, which have no compunction about hiring people to start at the bottom and stay there, is to start or start over at the professional level. The opportunity to start your own business and be your own boss has in large part been replaced by the opportunity to become a professional and have some autonomy within somebody else's organization. We will see, though, that this coveted autonomy is restricted in the most fundamental way. Today's emphasis on finding your opportunity within the corporations keeps alive the ideology of opportunity, an ideology that serves the corporations indirectly by generating support for the hierarchical setup as a whole, as mentioned above. But the shift in the location of opportunity does something extra for the employers. It channels your efforts to escape into the direct service of the corporations. To become eligible for the better jobs within the corporation, you work to develop the skills that the corporations value. Thus, the name of the biggest game in the land of opportunity today is making yourself more valuable to the bosses. And because the employer assesses your value mainly by examining your credentials, the paper chase is on. A few generations ago, what worker would have sought college credit for work experience, an advertising point for colleges today? Who would have cared much about mail-order term papers and degrees? Today, more than ever, workers see their great opportunity for escape from unsatisfying working lives in terms of further schooling, professional training, degrees, credentials, licenses, and certificates. Local college parking lots fill up after 5 p.m. Employers eagerly pay the tuition, even though worker turnover is high, and few of the workers who do stick around will be reassigned to more productive jobs based on their evening studies. The company springs for the course fees less to upgrade its workforce than to sustain the ideology of opportunity and keep employees oriented toward individual rather than collective solutions. Wage workers are not the only ones forced to adopt new career strategies because of the large corporations' tightening grip on the economy. As C. Wright Mills notes in White Collar, his classic study of the new little man, rather than carry on his father's business, many a boy has been trained at his parents' sacrifice to help man some of the big business system that has destroyed his father's business. But there is a rub. The number of openings for professional positions is limited, and no one is guaranteed a slot. For those forced to defect from family business to big business, having to actually compete for a position as a subordinate employee adds insult to injury. For workers, the limitation on openings is simply a reminder that for them, the more the system evolves, the more it stays the same. As those who shift out of family businesses enter into competition with the children of professionals for the limited number of professional jobs, workers without either of these advantageous backgrounds find that, once again, as with their right to compete with the corporations, only relatively few workers can benefit from the opportunity to compete within them. The fact that so many workers are actively pursuing at least some long-term program of officially recognized self-improvement, almost to the point that it is a national mania, does not mean that a large number of higher-level positions are waiting for people to fill them. It simply means a large number of people are not satisfied with their positions, and a rather narrow path to better ones has been laid out. Each step along the path has been specified in detail, effectively standardizing and circumscribing workers' efforts toward advancement. The pursuit of opportunity has been rationalized and institutionalized. I've been reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. If you've missed any of the readings done on prior weeks of the program, you can find them in our show archive on the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org. The readings begin with show number 175. Jeff Schmidt, the author of this book, was trained as a physicist and also worked for 19 years as a writer and editor for the publication Physics Today. He was fired following the publication of this book. If you'd like to contact us, you can also do so through the website unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guests, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all